This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
March Madness is here, and if you want to enhance the experience, join me, Gary Parrish, and my colleague Matt Norlander on the Ion College Basketball Podcast, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. We have new episodes at least three times a week and at the end of every night of the NCAA tournament. So before you go to bed, hang with us or know we'll be there when you awake. We'll break down games, make picks against the spread. Most of all, we'll have a blast. So join us on the Ion College Basketball Podcast on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This week, I'm in a brand new restaurant in Maplewood called Robin with Alex Shingle, the owner and chef.
Yes.
Thank you for inviting me here.
Thank you very much. Thanks for being here.
Well, let's start with your background a little bit.
Sure.
Where did you come from before here?
So I had been doing the Robin Project as a series of pop-up dinners and private dinners for about 2.5 years leading up to that. But primarily before that, I was with the Rooster and the Hen, I think now called Take Root Hospitality Group, working with them. I was the part of the opening team at Vicia and was there for about 2.5 years, and then moved over and was at Winslow's Table for about 2.5 years, was the opening executive chef, and then worked there through the pandemic until about spring of 2022.
Vicia and Winslow's Table actually have done previously for Roaming St. Louis.
Right on. That's awesome.
So what was the idea behind the whole Robin concept?
So it's been percolating in my head pretty much since I started cooking, which would have been about 15, 16 years ago. Wanted to have my own space. That was kind of the goal from the beginning. In its most current iteration, it's about figuring out what does Midwestern cuisine look like, and realizing that most of the restaurants that I was drawn to were telling a story about the people that or where they're from, the time that they're from, and just telling the story of their own heritage, whether it's like obviously Noma up in Copenhagen or Sean Brock telling the story of the southern food, but just wanted to kind of explore that without really having any set direction, and kind of knowing that Midwestern food can be kind of looked at as a bit of a joke. It's a lot of casseroles. It's a lot of, well, what does that really mean? And just trying to explore that and see if there's something deeper and see if there's something more valuable in it. And so far we're finding value in it. We're trying to explore that.
What is Midwestern cuisine then?
I have more questions than I have answers, to be honest with you. So it starts with farmers. It starts with the great agricultural products that come from here, and that includes obviously the things that modern people are learning to grow, and new seeds and new ideas with that. But it's also something as simple as a place like Funk's Grove, which has been making maple syrup in their family just over in Illinois for, gosh, I want to say like 7 generations or so, and they've been selling it by what used to be Route 66 for almost 100 years now. So to me, that's as much a Midwestern heritage product as corn or the pork that we're growing or the great dairy that we have here. And then to me, it's about exploring some of the recipes and some of the ideas that took place kind of pre convenient food and industrialization of our food system. So that's not just current times, but also going all the way back to like post-World War II, where everything became canned and frozen and convenience foods, thinking back to like how can we go back to making everything really from scratch and really from honest whole ingredients, and thinking of it that way.
How does that present itself on your menu?
So one of the dishes that I think is the best example of this is we do a dish for our second course called hot dish. Hot dish is a term for casserole up in the upper Midwest. My mom's side of the family is from North Dakota. So if you're from Minnesota, a casserole is called a hot dish. And one of the products from that area is wild rice. So it's pretty common to see a casserole made with like cream of mushroom soup or cream of chicken soup or whatever, wild rice, cooked whatever. So what we do instead is we get great shiitakes, hanchimeji mushrooms, oyster mushrooms, cook those with a lot of onions, make a really delicious puree along with a lot of cream from Rolling Lawns Dairy. We then take those same mushrooms, it's all kind of folded together, and then topped with wild rice that's been puffed, almost like Rice Krispies kind of thing. So it's a totally different eating experience. I think it's a dish that if you came from not knowing the heritage of that, it would still play as like, oh wow, that's a thoughtful, awesome, interesting dish. But if you know, it kind of is an interesting tweak on that same idea of a kind of classic dish represented and kind of contextualized. So
can you give me another example?
Oh goodness,
I mean, that was a good one. I'm sorry, that is a good one, but
yeah, no, I another one that's a great one would be paternal grandma was named Dorothy, and when I came back from a stage working in Belgium, I began to kind of explore some of these ideas, and I remember asking her, if she could remember when she was a little girl, what were the things that she remembered eating and liking. And I remember she said, well, one of my favorite memories is in the springtime having boiled new potatoes with clobbered cream. And I remember thinking, oh, God.
Clobbered cream.
What is clobbered cream? Second of all, like, okay, I don't know what I can really do with this, but if that's grandma's favorite, then okay, whatever. And followed up, and clobbered cream, I think, was basically their version of like a sour cream. It was that, okay. Is that when they got dairy, when they got milk, the cream naturally separated, and they would just kind of scoop off the cream, and they would kind of put it in a separate container. And I'm guessing it just had enough bacteria that as it kind of would go, it would kind of sour naturally. So it was their version of just kind of having a creme fraiche or a sour cream, and they called it clobbered cream in a kind of Polish, broken English kind of thing. And I remember, having this conversation, thinking, okay, well, that doesn't seem like an avenue to explore. And a few days later, watching an Anthony Bourdain show where he's in Paris and he's talking to Joël Robuchon, who's an extraordinarily acclaimed chef. And he said, what would be your last meal? What's your favorite thing to eat? And he says, oh, a baked potato and a slab of butter, and I'm happy. And it's like, oh, okay, maybe there's something to this. So we've kind of chefed it up a little bit, but basically we just do a really really strongly salted salt-boiled potato with sour cream that we make in-house, a little bit of fine herbs, and we chef it up a little bit with a little bit of trout caviar, trout roe, which, again, is a great source from the Midwest. So try to keep everything kind of from here, but that's a kind of classic homage to a dish my grandma hopefully would recognize from her childhood, so...
I love that. It was not lost on me that you said you worked in Belgium.
I did, yes. Yeah, so let's see. Kind of in the middle of my career. So I started here in St. Louis, worked at the Chase Park Plaza for a few years, and then moved over. I got the opportunity to work for Gerard Kraft at Niche Restaurant back in like 2009, something like that. So I was there for about 2 years, 1 year at the old space in Benton Park, and then 1 year in Clayton. And left there as a sous chef, traveled a little bit, and ended up in Charleston for a little bit, and later got
South Carolina.
Charleston, South Carolina.
Great food town.
Unbelievable food town. Was able to stage at McCrady's, which was Sean Brock's main restaurant there. I staged there for about a month and a half or so.
And that means?
It basically means you work for free.
Wow.
Is what it means.
No, we're good. We're good. Okay.
I got to pull Brett really
quick. No, you're good. You're good.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's no problem.
Restaurant does not stop.
Yeah, the bread is coming out. Well.
Sorry about that. Bread doesn't stop for anybody.
That's right.
So
I love that.
So, yeah, spent some time in Charleston, and then a chef I admired announced that they were looking for stagiaires in Belgium, a guy named Kobe Desremaults, who worked at or owned a restaurant called In De Wolf, which he since has decided to close, and he's opened a different spot in Brussels now. But yeah, it was an honor to go and work for him for about 3 months. After that, I came back and worked at Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is where I ultimately met Michael and Tara and connected with them to kind of join them at Vizia later on. So,
right.
So,
and
yeah,
that's
the career in as quick as I can say. So,
good. I mean, but working for free obviously is it's a sacrifice.
It is. It's, you know, the way I think of it, and I've had to sometimes justify high debt on my credit card as I've, you know, been in relationships, which isn't ideal. But the reality is I don't have student loans. And to me, I think of staging and that period of my life as kind of graduate school. It was my opportunity to kind of know that, like okay, as a sous chef at Niche Restaurant in 2010, 2011, like I could have gone and kind of made my way through a lot of good restaurants and really done, you know, had a lot of opportunities, you know, presented to me. But I didn't feel ready for it. I didn't feel like I had enough knowledge and I felt confident being able to, like, have all the skills that I wanted to bring for what, like, my future held. So to me, it was like, I need to go and I need to learn and I need to see more and I need to kind of push myself and see things that, like, you just can only kind of see when you're there, which, you know, is a little quaint now that the world has just kind of become so open to seeing everything via video and Instagram and Reels and all that. But, like, you know, even 10, 15 years ago, it was hard to really picture some of these things and experience them unless you were just really there. So, yeah, all that kind of period was really important for me to get to where I am now. I don't think that I would have been able to do that had I not kind of left and then ultimately, like, been able to kind of travel around and see those things and then come back with a better kind of picture of what I thought I could bring to the community here and opening a restaurant.
Well, it's a Midwestern themed restaurant. What did you learn while you were in Belgium?
So ironically, I wrote a lot of, like, journals as I was there because it was a really formative experience. I know a lot, like, the classic one that a lot of people think about is going to Italy, and then they come back with all these amazing, like, pasta shapes and recipes and these things. And it's like, ironically, I went to Belgium not really to learn how to make Belgian food. Like, obviously there's techniques and there's things that I learned and there's subtle things here and there. It was more about recognizing that here's this person who was doing the kind of same thing in his corner of the world where, like, nobody really was celebrating Flemish Belgian food.
Interesting.
It was kind of this in-between area between, like, the classic kind of very, very classic cooking of France and the very kind of like avant-garde from what was happening in Scandinavia. And he was kind of doing both. He was kind of doing some foraging. He was doing some really intensely, like, vegetable forward, you know, good farming cooking, the same way like Alain Passard at L'Arpège was. So, but it was, again, all about referencing where he was from and the places that he was from, the great products and the great kind of classic dishes reimagined in his restaurant. And it was like another kind of push towards, like, I think this seems to be the most interesting thing. I think this is, and I think maybe it was a bit self-defeating too, and it's hard to, you know, get into the psychology of this, but it's that I think pretty quickly in my career I walked into kitchens and realized I was not the most talented person. Like, there was always somebody that was better, faster, had more technique, but that ultimately, That's just a rat, right? Like, you're always going to find that. There's always going to be somebody that knows more than you and can outdo with, like, more garnishes or more this or more that. So to me, it became more interesting to be like, well, what is the story I want to tell? What's the idea that makes this interesting? And then how do we kind of make this in a restaurant that feels comfortable and feels good, and it starts to become part of it all, and it doesn't just become about, like, a lecture of the food on the plate and about, like, my own family. It becomes kind of a more communal thing, and it becomes about, like, okay, well, hospitality in the Midwest becomes a more generous, more kind of comfortable thing. So that began to shape the idea of the decor and the overall service ideas, where like we really made a lot of decisions. We're continuing to hopefully tweak and work on the idea that it should be a comfortable experience. Like, we're not going to apologize for having great, you know, silverware and great, you know, things that we, you know, want to enjoy as a more fine dining experience. But you can't walk into a place that's celebrating the Midwest and have anxiety that you're doing this wrong or this is stressful or whatever. Like, that's, we've already kind of lost it. So
yeah, right.
it's gotta ultimately still feel really like comforting and nice and just feel easy and feel like, you know, hospitable. So
I love that concept. I love the idea of the storytelling or the story and also the comfortability and the Midwestern ethos that,
yeah,
that seems to be something that, you know, a lot of restaurants may not have here. So you might have hit on something.
I think everybody tries to. I mean, it's and I hope we succeed. I mean, the reality is, like, you know, there's going to be times that we don't succeed and that, you know, we can't be perfect every single time. But it stems from, I think, partly viewing fine dining vicariously now as much as us do. And since the pandemic we do, where we'll see people going to visit 3 Michelin star restaurants and putting that 12-minute video up on YouTube and there's this and that, whatever. And then, of course, there's the old stories of, like, you know, I don't know, the one I think of is like Pretty Woman, where Julia Roberts is in the restaurant and it's like, oh, you're using the wrong fork or this or that, whatever. And me bringing either, you know, my parents or my brother or my girlfriend, my partner to, like, other restaurants that I'm excited by, it's easy to see through their eyes that, like, oh, this is foreign. This is not normal. And that, like, other people can find this a very anxiety-inducing thing to be in this situation. And the ones that really succeed are the ones that still deliver that really high level of attention to detail, but also make it feel really comforting and put you at ease very quickly and let you know, like, you're not doing anything wrong. You're okay to eat this way and do this way. And, like, it's not about being at a restaurant for, like, the flex of it, for, like, oh, look at all the stars I've been able to go and eat at. It's just about having a nice night out to spend with friends and family and enjoy yourself. So,
but you still consider this fine dining.
I mean, it's about context. I think we have to, because I think in St. Louis, this is going to be presented as such, especially for the price point that we're doing. And I'm aware of that. And I'm aware that once we get to a 4-course, you know, menu, that's what it is. I think, you know, to me, if this was put in a neighborhood in Paris, this would just be a bistro. You know what,
yeah,
I mean? Like, it's,
yeah,
I don't think we'd get a star. I think we wouldn't even come close to being on a Michelin level radar at all. This would just be kind of a daily menu, you know, neighborhood, you know, hopefully well thought of bistro thing. So it's just all about context. I think the reality though is, I think, you know, for what we're doing here, I'm aware that this is a more upscale, you know, space, and then that, you know, it's not no money. Like, we try to exhibit and bring a lot of value to it, and we think we do. We think that for what we charge, we're really competitive compared to other people that, you know, kind of do it on a la carte menu. But it's still a substantial amount of money. So, you know, we have to be aware that we're really trying to make it worth it and make it a good value. So, yeah.
When I first came in or looked through the door, I thought this place was twice as big as it is.
Yeah, it's small.
It's small because of the mirrors.
Yeah, yeah.
But so it is very intimate.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that's part of just the space. But to be fair, we also spent a lot of time looking for a space that would fit the concept we want to do. So doing the pop-up dinners for as long as I did really put me, like, right in the dining room most of the time, where I'm cooking for 8 to 10 people and able to, like, go out and talk to people and really engage. And I looked at a few different spaces that were a lot larger. And I think, one, you know, it just felt more of a good fit to be here because, you know, the dining room is kind of right here where the kitchen is, and the kitchen is right in,
yeah,
the dining,
I mean,
room. Like, there's,
yeah,
no separation whatsoever. But at the same time, and this was also important to me, I didn't want to do the chef's counter model where you're all just kind of staring at me and it's food as theater, which can be great. And I loved going to those sometimes, but I wanted it to, again, thinking through like the Midwest and what it meant to be Midwestern, it felt better for me to like have people be able to really just sit at the table with their friends, their family, whoever it may be, and enjoy it just amongst themselves. And you don't owe me anything as a guest to like pay attention to my stories and listen to this or do that or whatever. You just have to come in and enjoy yourself and have a good time and know that like we've thought about all those details and they're really important to us. And if you are curious, we're happy to engage and talk to you and tell you all about why, you know, we are making cultured butter for our bread service or why there's porridge in it or all these things.
Porridge.
Yeah, our bread is called porridge bread.
Okay.
Like I said, we can go deep on almost everything. But that, you know, ultimately it's just a really delicious bread and you don't have to. You can just enjoy
bread
it.
Good bread is good bread.
Yeah.
So what was this space before?
So this space was originally owned and operated by Ben Perembo. It's called the Benevolent King.
Okay.
You'd have to chat with him a little bit more. My understanding it was his kind of celebration of Moroccan cooking, I think, which is some of his family's heritage. But I don't know 100%
about it. So it's at the corner of Manchester and Southwest.
Yeah, we have great neighbors. We're right next to a Chero restaurant.
Yeah.
And then to the left is a ZB's, which is a fair grades, a fair trade, like goods and products retailer. So
yeah, busy spot for sure.
Yeah, awesome.
And where did the name Robin come from?
Short answer is it's my mother's name.
Oh, okay.
it's not explicitly named after her. It was... again, this is a concept a long time in the making, and you start to think of names. And I had a really specific set of criteria in my mind of like, well, it can't be a French name if I'm making it Midwestern. It can't be an Italian name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be something that people can stumble into saying incorrectly. I still find it surprising, but like people would mispronounce Vissia a lot, and you would see that people feeling uncomfortable, and that was unforeseen. Like we didn't think that would happen, or I'm sure they didn't when that was the name that they settled on. So it was about a lot of those things, and then again, I think I saw somewhere that another restaurant in New York had named the restaurant. I won't say which one had decided on a name for a restaurant. I remember thinking like, huh, that's an interesting name. And later on it said like, well, they named it that because the chef's owner was their mother. And I immediately thought, oh, well, okay.
Okay.
And I realized like, oh, well, that's actually kind of great because, you know, you can never criticize somebody who names their something after their
right.
mom, you know, like even if it's a bad name, it's it's their mom. So, and then the fact that, you know, the double meaning, the fact that it's a you know, symbol of early spring and, you know, a nice, a lovely little bird, humble and you know, maybe worth appreciating a little bit more. So it all kind of works together. So.
And do you do all the cooking or you have a staff?
No. Of course, we have a staff. Yeah, we've got a great, great staff that's been enormously helpful as we've kind of gotten going. We had our first service really about two Fridays ago. We had our friends and family in. And, you know, slowly but steadily, I am delegating more and more duties. And they're really eager, actually, to take on more duties so that I'm not as kind of frantically trying to do everything. But, yeah, we've got a fantastic staff that's really crushing it and really proud to have them here.
Is there anything else you wanted to mention about your new restaurant?
No, just you know, reservations are available. So
okay.
You know, we're always excited to have people join us and bring more awareness to the restaurant and happy to cook for people. And I hope that people don't see the kind of four course or the price point and feel in any way intimidated by it. We're really, really welcoming, and happy to provide as much hospitality and as much great food as we can.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be in a new spot that just opened and to present it to people. Robin Restaurant in Maplewood. Alex Shingle is the owner and chef. Thanks so much for inviting me here. It's really cool, and I look forward to eating your food.
Thanks for coming and chatting. We appreciate it.